dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The man whose intelligence we have the privilege of tapping from time to time is our first guest. He's Peter Husey. He is, among other things, the Director for Strategic Deterrence Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. He teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy. He is a senior defense consultant at the National Defense University Foundation. And, if that weren't enough, he runs a company called Strategic Analysis, and I believe he is speaking in that capacity today. Peter Husey, it's good to have you with us. I want to visit with you a little bit about a topic we'll be discussing further with our next guest, David Wormser, Iran. Peter, you have been following what the Iranian regime of the Ayatollahs has been doing for decades, of course, and you've been warning, I think, about the real prospect of a nuclear weapon coming into the hands of such a regime with its deep-seated enmity towards us. Give us a flavor as to where you think things stand right now on that account, how close they are, and more to the point, Peter, also, how we've been trying to check that under President Trump.
Well, I would first to say that the Iranians have recently launched another space launch vehicle, and my understanding is that the satellite they put up is in orbit. The only thing has been officially said by the United States Department of Defense, by General Hyten, who's the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, is that the launch went a very considerable distance. I've seen other data that says it's some notional satellite is in orbit, but it supposedly doesn't contain carry anything deadly or anything. But it indicates, as our Israeli friends, Uzi Rubin, who's one of the specialists in the business on Iran, a capability that could easily become a ICBM or long-range intercontinental ballistic missile capability. That's number one. Number two, there was an explosion in a enrichment facility in Iran, and unfortunately, some of the news is that the Iranians are only using very primitive what are called R1 and R2 centrifuges, and those are not capable of producing enough enriched material for a nuclear device. And I went back and did a whole bunch of just research, and they have been producing not R1s and R2s, but R4s and 5s. And given the fact that even the Vienna people at the United Nations have said to the Iranians, you have not agreed, you're not implemented the agreement that was signed in 2015 about giving us access to those sites we wanted to look at. We don't know where the Iranians may or may not have military capabilities in the nuclear business. So that's one of the reasons the administration withdrew from what was called the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action. It's not joint. It's not comprehensive. It's not a program of action. It's basically as the Israelis, Netanyahu has pointed out, it's a smokescreen behind which the Iranians have been able to build up what General Hayden, who unfortunately recently passed away, has said, former Air Force General, Director of National Intelligence, said they're building an industrial strength nuclear capability. And he wasn't talking about nuclear energy, he was talking about nuclear weapons. So they have the ability, growing ability to launch the thing, and they have we don't know the complete dimensions of how much nuclear capability they have. Well, when you have a situation with a regime that says death to America every 5 minutes, that is killed along with Hezbollah, their ally, and their terror group, killed more Americans than anybody, I think even including, if you include al-Qaeda, given the fact that Iranians had a role in 9/11. This is a very deadly group of people that have made war on Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, Israel. I mean, where have they not been launching, helping people with weapons and money, and then we turn around and give them $150 billion under the previous administration, which we then admitted was going to be used for terrorism.
So, Peter Husey, this is a good overview. We're in a mess. The Trump administration has, as you mentioned, withdrawn from this so-called JCPOA. They've imposed something they call the maximum pressure sanctions regime. And yet, you've pointed out in a piece recently at thejewishpress.com that there are lots of holes in that maximum pressure campaign, and that Congress is looking at ways of plugging those holes. Where does that stand, and is it likely to make a difference soon, do you think?
Yes, the Iranians are clever, and they have, unfortunately, witting and unwittingly allies in, unfortunately, Europe, and, of course, with Russia and China. So they try to go around the serious sanctions, which in this administration's, to its credit, they have done yeoman's work in this area. But the question is, when you have allies in Europe and then you have enemies like Russia and China who are doing everything possible to go around sanctions and to help them, the Iranians with technology and so forth, even with the embargo on importing weapons and exporting weapons expiring in October, which was part of the nuclear deal, which was added in as like, why are we doing this? The embargo should stay in place. You're right. There are holes, but the holes are there by our allies and enemies that are making a great effort to make sure those holes are there. The administration, bit by bit, is moving towards what I hope is a web around Iran. So their finances are taken down. Their money is taken out, their weapons. We interdict their exports to particularly Yemen and other places. And this is a tough job to do, as you know, Frank. Sanctions can work, but they are tough because we got, unfortunately, we don't have cooperative allies and we have very uncooperative enemies in Russia and China. So we have a work cut out for us. I have got to hand it to the administration. Their heart is in the right place. Their actions have been in the right place. But this is very, very tough because, unfortunately, as you know, we have something called the deep state. And it's not just the intelligence community, the others who want to prove that we can make a deal with Iran on nuclear issues, like we can make a deal with Korea, like we can make a deal with our enemies, as opposed to taking the action needed to have what Reagan called peace through strength, which is, you know, you can't make a deal with these people without cutting back on your own security. And that just happens to be the fact of life.
Peter, as you look at this tough problem, and there's no question that it is a tough problem, it's going to get considerably tougher, I think it's fair to say, if this arms embargo is ended. As you mentioned, the Russians and the Chinese want to help the Iranians get out from under that. Who knows, maybe even some of the Europeans might. Your quick prognosis on that problem?
Well, my worry is that the Europeans don't want to extend it. They want so desperately to do business with Iran. Russia and China definitely don't want to extend it. The Russians have said forget it because they want to sell weapons to the Iranians, and the Iranians have cash from the sale of oil and gas. So then the question is how much we can sanction Russia and China's banks and various institutions if they so much as sell a handgun to the Iranians. I hope we do it because it will slow them down. It will not necessarily end it. But I think, look, if the Israelis were responsible for the explosion at the nuclear facility in Iran, God love them, they take this thing seriously. Sanctions and stuff is not necessarily the only thing you can do. I'm not in favor of sending troops to Iran. I don't want to bomb Tehran. But this is serious stuff. And the people that kind of watch is, what are the Israelis doing who are right in the crosshairs, the Iranians? Well, if they did what they did it because they had to.
Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that. We'll talk more about what the Israelis may or may not have done to contribute to current problems the Iranian regime is having. Peter, again, thank you for your time today and the work you do at Geostrategic Analysis. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with David Wormser. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. As promised, we are going to visit in this block with David Wormser. He's an extraordinary public servant, now fortunately on the staff of the Center for Security Policy. But in previous incarnations, he has served in the uniform of the United States Navy, rising to the rank of a lieutenant commander with a specialization in intelligence. He has served in several different capacities in the government, including notably as a Middle East advisor to then Vice President Dick Cheney. He's also served as a special assistant to John Bolton and as a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. These days, David's portfolio is fighting global anti-Semitism and defending the U.S.-Israeli relationship at the Center for Security Policy. We're always delighted to catch up with him. David, welcome back. I'm anxious particularly to talk with you, as we were doing a little bit with Peter Husey in the previous segment, David, about what's happening on the ground at the moment in Tehran and other parts of, well, what one might call the Iranian military-industrial complex. Peter touched on it, but give us sort of a more detailed assessment of what's been happening, and then we'll talk about perhaps whose hands.
Well, sure. I think we've had now about 10, 12 days of really interesting accidents in Iran. And at first, one could say it could be an accident because the Iranian government is so incompetent and riddled by such corruption that accidents became commonplace and people were numbed to their existence. But this is a whole different category, a whole different level. So I'd start with the third incident, which happened. These incidents were happening almost every 2 days, and at some points even every day. The third incident was the explosion of the shed in, it's not a shed, it's a very large building in Natanz Nuclear Enrichment Facility. This is where all the new generation centrifuges are being assembled to vastly accelerate the Iranian enrichment capacity so that they could reach breakout within a month or two rather than a year or two. All this was allowed, by the way, under the nuclear deal with President Obama, that they were allowed to build these centrifuges. They just weren't allowed to actually use them. So they were assembling them, and all of a sudden, the building in which they were assembled on the third day of these various strikes, which is July 2nd, it was exploded, and the imagery shows a vast destruction of the building. And Iran at first didn't admit it, but now they're essentially saying, yeah, it was that. The enrichment structure, and two, it is severe damage. So Iran's program has been set back. But this is not the only incident. We had the first day attacks on a missile base where the long-range missiles are being assembled, and one believes the nuclear warhead design is being tested and developed. Same night, there was a power plant in Shiraz that was exploded. In between these two events, there was a huge explosion and fire in a small medical clinic, only a 4 or 5 story building that apparently had 2 or 3 stories sublevel, which is odd. And it exploded there, a big explosion. I would only note that in Gaza, the Iranians have placed sensitive missile structures underneath hospitals. So just because it's a medical clinic, and even a real medical clinic, doesn't mean it isn't a military facility as well. Then you had 2 nights later in Ahvaz, another power plant exploded, a petrochemical plant collapsed essentially and started leaking gas. All along you have demonstrations in various Iranian cities, the currency's collapsing, and there's a run on the banks. So it looks to me like there's a two-pronged assault going on here. One is a clear strikes on the military structures of Iran that deal with their nuclear and missile programs, and one instantly would think the Israelis might have something to do with it. And then there's also this regime destabilizing activity going on, which clearly the Iranian opposition is involved with. And for me, this is not a contradictory thing. The Israelis, the Israelis do work with Iran's opposition. So it's quite possible that this is a concerted, unified effort.
And there's very little doubt in your mind, and presumably in the Ayatollah's mind, that the Israelis are implicated in some degree or another. Is that right?
Yeah, they definitely think it's the Israelis. I find it very interesting that yesterday the Iranians while still denying that it's an attack, said they will get retaliation for the attack. But they said they will hit those who were helping, not Israel or the United States, which were the two likely perpetrators. And, you know, Frank, I remember over the last 15 years, you and I have been treated to this constant diet of nothing less than the apocalypse if Israel struck Iran's nuclear program. And you had it from the whole Washington elite that, oh, my God, that would be the end of the world. And here it seems to have happened. And the Iranians may not even retaliate directly.
A very interesting point. And I remember also similarly apocalyptic pronouncements being made when President Trump was considering actually fulfilling the promise that he and I think his four previous predecessors had made to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem as well. And again, that didn't have that effect.
You know, Frank, you're used to it. You back in the 80s already saw how Washington during the INF talks in Reykjavik, when Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, walked out, the reactions were, we're now at the edge of a nuclear World War III.
So let me ask you, David Wormser, for your expert opinion, whatever the provenance of these strikes, and obviously they weren't strikes involving conventional forces, they were presumably clandestine operations in which the Israelis are, let's be honest, very skilled. How badly has the Iranian nuclear weapons program and missile program, for that matter, been affected, would you believe to be the case?
Well, at first, Western rumors and intelligence officials leaking suggested perhaps a 3 to 4 month delay. But now people are saying a year plus delay. And it's a very serious assault. My suspicion is that the core of how they were going to go about the enrichment is devastated. And that means it's probably a year or more, which pushes the can down the road, of course. But that is a big question, too, is what next?
So, David, one of the things that I touched on with Peter as well, I'd like to get your thoughts on. It seems as though if the government of Iran does not fall as a result of all of this, and hopefully more, especially in the hands of the Iranian people themselves, that the mullahs will shortly once again have legal access to a host of conventional arms. And we know what will happen with those arms. Of course, they will be used either directly or through proxies to harm, well, our interests and perhaps our people and those of others in the region and beyond, not least Israel, one would expect. What's your reading on that situation? Are we likely to be able to somehow manage to perpetuate the existing embargo, given that the Europeans, as Peter pointed out, and certainly the Russians and Chinese want the thing to be ended?
Yeah, I think that is the big question. I mean, you know, if the Israelis acted now, it was two timelines. And one was obviously the election here and needing to get things done under any eventuality in the United States. But the second one was exactly this, the conventional weapons embargo, the failure to reimpose it. There's the snapback options, but and the JCPOA, the Iran deal. But at the end of the day, I think it is going to be very difficult to keep China, Russia, and Europeans from selling Iran equipment that could be very dangerous on the conventional level. And that is something the United States is going to have to deal with. The one thing that may intervene here, and this may be part of the reason for the destabilizing attacks, the Iranian government may be facing somewhat of an internal putsch where the IRGC takes over more brazenly. I mean, they're really the power behind the throne anyway, but was this fiction?
This is the Iranian Revolutionary or Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
To believe that Rouhani or Zarif really defined Iran was to willfully ignore the reality of the Iranian regime. I think what you're seeing here is that hidden face will come out brazenly as the overt face with much more serious internal repression. and that will make it difficult for the Europeans. As far as the Russians go, the Israelis seem to have some sort of channel with Putin where they seem to work out understandings as to what's allowed in certain areas. And the Russians themselves are having great headaches with Iran in Syria. So it's possible the Russians want the big problems, the Chinese. And you just saw just two days ago, the Chinese and Iran signed this 25-year strategic agreement. This is a very worrisome development.
One of the reasons why we value so much your time with us, David Wormser, as well as the work you're doing at the Center for Security Policy, is that these are indeed very troubling developments. We know you'll stay on it. We hope you'll come back to us again with updates very soon. Next up, we'll speak with J.R. Jeff Nyquist, one of the brightest minds we have on both terrestrial and extraterrestrial challenges we're facing. And more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Jeff Nyquist. He is a prodigious contributor to the public policy debate about some of the most important issues of our time. He has two particularly noteworthy books, The Origins of the Fourth World War and The New Tactics of Global War. You can find his writings in places like Newsmax and WorldNet Daily and Epoch Times, and we're very grateful to him for his time and his expertise. And Jeff, thank you very much for joining us again. It's good to have you back. I want to sort of on an ongoing basis take stock with you, Jeff, on what is happening with what is, I think, increasingly being recognized as a revolution in our country. It's not just protests. It's not even just an insurrection. It's more than that. And I think increasingly, my sense is that people have come to realize that we're dealing with Marxist revolutionaries doing business as the Black Lives Matter organization. Your thoughts?
Yes. Of course, we're talking about critical race theory. We're talking about Black Lives Matter and Freedom Road Socialist Organization. And we're talking about Liberty Road roads. And these are Maoist Marxist organizations and the Black Lives Movement also, these are umbrella organizations of it. And it has the tactics it's using are Maoist. This is pretty clear in the timing of it with the pandemic, with the break in relations with China is very, very interesting.
Not an accident, comrade. I think it's the way it's put in the old Soviet Union, at least. To what extent have we seen, in addition to kind of those important data points, evidence that the Chinese Communist Party itself may be encouraging this kind of behavior? It's certainly part of their playbook out of the unrestricted warfare doctrine. Do you see evidence of it?
Well, the biggest evidence was their declaration some months ago of a people's war against, you know, they didn't exactly name us, but they meant us, a people's war against the United States. And when I first heard and read about this people's war, I was like riveted, like a people's war. That's a Maoist, that's a communist term. And of course, the Chinese like to use this race issue because they're not Europeans, and they see it colonialism as a major theme for them because of their own history with the West, with capitalism. And so a lot of the themes here dovetail. And when here's the thing, you know, when I was in graduate school, the lady who tried to convert me to communism was a Sioux Indian. And so I really had a double moment when the Lakota Sioux came out and said that they wanted to destroy, you know, the Mount Rushmore because it was built on stolen Indian land. And I very much remembered her, and I thought of that, and I thought, my goodness, this is, you know, every single possible enemy that we could have, they will unite with. If somebody is still angry about the Indian Wars, they can unite with them. If there's somebody still angry about slavery, they can unite with them. Whatever America's tried to do to make the world more fair, make its political system more fair, doesn't matter. It's dredge up every single grievance from the past.
Jeff, I want to turn to a different topic. There's a bit of a segue to it because China is seemingly being very heavily impacted by something you put me onto with one of your blogs back in June. You entitled the post, Chinese Strategy and the Solar Minimum. Tell us what the solar minimum is and what impact it is having around the world, but quite notably on communist China at the moment.
Well, there's the solar minimum, the normal one, happens every average 11 years when the sun goes through its cycle. It's 11-year cycle. And what happens is sunspot activity goes away. The sun's electromagnetic field collapses and reverses, and then it charges up again. And but there's something called the grand solar minimum that happens on an average every 206 years. In the cycle theory, one of the theories is that there's a irregularity in the core of the sun that causes it. They don't exactly know. But what we do know from the science, I just finished Henrik Svensmark's book on climate. They're realizing that clouds, that is rain clouds, are caused by cosmic rays or muons, which become much more numerous when the sun's electromagnetic field goes down, and to the extent that it goes down and the length of time it goes down. And that muons, they're heavy electrons from exploded stars in the center of the galaxy, usually. Sometimes a local supernova can cause it. They are these heavy particles. They help to form clusters above the oceans that water molecules can form around and to form the rain clouds. And of course, the prediction would be that you would have in the solar minimum a flooding, a spring flooding, possibly going into summer. And in a grand solar minimum, which we appeared to be entering, for it to be long enough to lower the global temperatures. And right now in China, we're seeing massive flooding. We've had abnormally heavy rains in the U.S. and in some regions, and crops have been affected. In China especially, the price of rice is up 70%, rye up 50%. The wheat crop was affected by a late freeze in April. The real problem here is that, you know, when you have this this extended cloud cover, the summer sun doesn't get through.
Jeff Nyquist, let me just ask you about this grand solar minimum. The flooding that seems to be perhaps a result of it in China is massive. I'm told that some 26 out of the 50 Chinese provinces now have flooding. The city of Wuhan, I've been told, is about half of it underwater. This is a massive city, as we've learned from the Wuhan virus caper. To the extent that this is obviously a devastating event for the provinces that are affected, there's one other piece of this which is potentially even more horrific now in prospect, and that is that the flooding of the Yangtze River may well cause the collapse of the Three Gorges Dam, which is this huge project that the Chinese made one of their big prestige developments. But it sounds as though it is about to come a cropper with unbelievably massive effects downstream. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I understand there have been two earthquakes. I think one of them was in March that might have damaged the dam. And then you have, with them panicking of the dam possibly collapsing, they're seeing some kind of stress on the dam from the massive amount of water it was holding back. They started just releasing water downriver. And there was, I think, one city was told if you can't get up above the fourth floor, get out of the city, which is an kind of an incredible thing to hear, the idea that, of course, these Chinese rivers are very large. The amount of water that flows in them can be quite extensive. And, of course, when we look at floods, this kind of flooding in China, it does happen periodically. But this is one of those, you know, they talk about 5,000-year floods and, you know, 1,000-year floods. This is one of those kind of floods situations, which, of course, affects food production in the regime. And, of course, it might be, it's terrible for the Chinese people. It might be our luck in that China has been making such mischief for us. But it's interesting. The Russians have been saying this was coming, and they are allied with the Chinese. Their scientist at the Pukhovo Observatory, Dr. Abusamatov, wrote a paper in 2009 saying a grand solar minimum is coming. And Russia's actually laid down the keels of 3 nuclear icebreakers because of it, because of their belief that this is going to cause global cooling over the next decade, a 3 to 4 degree drop in global temperatures, because this kind of spring rain is going to continue.
So all the talk of late, including notably from Al Gore, about global warming may turn out to be bunk, and the cumulative effects of all of this, I'm given to understand, may be such as to create immense amounts of damage and death, should that dam break particularly, and that there is a pattern over the Chinese national history of floods accompanying or precipitating, more to the point, to the fall of regimes. And do you think that may well be in prospect for the Chinese Communist Party?
Yes, because they have 600 million people in China who live on less than $140 a month. And if the price of rice, already up 70% over January, goes up further, those people are not going to be able to afford to eat. And this is an extremely serious situation, especially with the economic distress on top of it. And of course, as you said, the change of dynasties in the past has coincided with these previous flood periods, which coincide, of course, with this grand solar minimum. It is possible that the Chinese, you know, science with the Russians knew something like this was coming. And it was part of their calculation, along with what Trump did to their trade situation, that they knew that the regime could be imperiled, not just by Trump, but also by the weather.
Fascinating. Jeff Nyquist, we will return to this with you next week, I'm sure. This is a Watch This Space issue, folks, of the First Order. Jeff, thanks as always for stimulating and often quite disturbing topics of conversation, but you shed such important light on them. We're delighted to be able to present you to our audience at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles about developments that are affecting our world, including in this country. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we have the privilege of being, as we often do, in-house, virtually, one of our good friends. His name is Robert Charles. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the George W. Bush State Department. He has served in a number of other capacities over the years, including as an attorney in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He's been a naval intelligence officer. He has also been enormously contributing to what I think all of the rest of us know and understand about our times, notably through his appearances on Fox News and his essays at the Association of Mature American Citizens, website for which is amac.us. Bobby Charles is an AMAC spokesman. We're so appreciative of your time, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for coming back on. Good to talk with you. Let's start with some of the ruminations you have been engaging in various outlets about this Well, I think of it as a revolution that is underway in our cities, a couple of pieces of which are very worrying. And I know from your experiences overseas that you've had some insights into what similar kinds of things have looked like elsewhere. Talk about that.
Yes, well, you put your finger on a very important point. You know, I'll reference AMAC just to say that some of us, you and I and others of the AMAC generation over the age of 50, grew up in a world that was defined by the Cold War. And to that end, I spent a little bit of time, a couple of different times in the Soviet Union and a couple of months in Soviet-dominated Poland. And really three things come to my mind in this current moment, and they're really arresting in my own mind's eye. The first is that a lot of our population today does not understand what socialism and communism is really about. If you wind the clock back and just spend a little bit of time understanding how the socialist governments repress every right that we deem important, from freedom of speech and worship to even just not being arrested and dragged off the street. I don't even know how to describe it except to say that it represses everything that we treasure as Americans. And I don't think people realize that that's what we're up against. The second thing is that people don't realize how fast it moves. You know, the Bolshevik Revolution took all of about 6 years, from 1917 to 23, and it was over. The Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949, had started in 1921, but the seeds were all laid ahead of time. We did our level best to try to prevent that, but we couldn't. So the second thing to note is that a very stable, seemingly very at ease, open, free society can, in a very short period of time, come under the influence and become essentially dominated by a socialist government, which is frightening. The third thing is really the practical or tactical side of all this. And I find it fascinating that a wonderful 4th of July passed a week or so ago, and yet we are looking at a situation in which much of the violence that occurred across the United States was not even reported by the mainstream media in those 3 or 4 days following. That disturbs me, because without law enforcement, we are up a creek without a paddle. We have to treasure, we have to understand the extraordinary pressures that are being placed on our law enforcement men and women today in every single major metropolitan area in the country. And I think to that end also, I just want to say that I talk with law enforcement a lot. And one of the things they've told me is that these events that are occurring now are definitely coordinated. The violence that continues to occur is coordinated. They've told me about plats of bricks that have been laid down everywhere from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. And it is a prearranged, you know, whether they were waiting for a flashpoint or this. And the saddest part about all this is that we can have a civil discussion about racial inequities and how to amend them, but that discussion has been sidetracked, hijacked, and taken away by these organized, I think, socialist and in some ways foreign-inspired disturbances, and it is very disturbing.
It is indeed, and I think your insights, Bobby, in terms of both the history of all of this and the implications of it becoming, you know, vastly more problematic is really important, and we, you know, fail to acknowledge it at our extreme peril.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things we're not hearing from, where is the mainstream media reporting what the police unions are saying? Where is the mainstream media reporting, which they're not, that 71% of the DC police force, which is 52% black, have said that if their qualified immunity is taken away, as the city council seems to want to do, they're going to put their papers in and leave. Where's the reporting that you have literally thousands of police officers who were injured in the recent spate of events in the last 3 weeks, really now 4 weeks? Where's the reporting from that police officers are saying, you know what, I am sick and tired of this? I mean, a 49% increase in the retirement requests in New York City's police force. This has got to be reported. And what I would encourage every listener to do, whether you're, you know, local in the D.C. area or you're national somewhere and accessing this broadcast, I would tell you, demonstrate your support to your local police, because by God, if we lose them and their support and we fail to acknowledge their selfless acts, then the next step is the ceding of all that ground to these socialist / communist, and anyways, you know, sort of hybrid fascists that are being inspired by foreign nationals.
I want to come back to the police in a minute. I did catch on Maria Bartiromo's show this morning. I believe it was a candidate for Congress in Miami by the name of Maria Elvira Salazar, who is, I believe, part of the Cuban American community in South Florida, and spoke very pointedly about the fact that, you know, you mentioned the term socialism, democratic socialism. She said, there's no such thing as democratic socialism. She said, it's like democratic fascism, you know. What? No way. It's communism, and it's maybe just a way station to it, but it is Marxist, it is totalitarian, and it is revolutionary in our own country. And so to come to the police, if I can, because I think this is such a critical part of the story, and with your background, notably at the State Department, with law enforcement affairs as part of your portfolio, you have a special appreciation of how that thin blue line really is vital to keeping the rest of us not only safe, but on the right side of truly disorder and mayhem and revolution in our own time. And I just would ask you, we're hearing more and more and more about the police being demoralized. We're hearing about large numbers retiring early. I think 400% more in New York City this time as opposed to last year this time. We're hearing about perhaps some of them choosing not to respond as promptly to reports of dangerous incidents. Talk about what all this means for the fabric of society.
Yep. I think that one of the things we have to do as observers, getting our news from a spattering and a smattering of different sources, is to put the dots together to create a pointillistic picture from what we're seeing, all these dots on the page. And I'll say four things pop off the page to me. One is that the police forces around the country are definitely demoralized. They do not understand why the public doesn't understand how vital their role is and what they do every day. I mean, they get up every day, they have families, and they put on a gun and a badge, and they go out to protect us. That's the first thing. The second thing is there is a nexus, and people need to understand it. All you have to do is go to the Customs and Border Patrol forms that people fill out coming into this country or to be a naturalized citizen to understand that if you are advocating the toppling of our democratic government, you're not welcome as a naturalized citizen in this country. And you know, when you're seeking through violent means to overturn the United States government, you are on the other side of the law, which leads me to the third point, which is that we cannot lose the ability to distinguish between lawful and lawless behavior. The toppling of statues, I mean, the most recent are a combination of union leaders but also political leaders, including, you know, ironically enough, Frederick Douglass statue had recently toppled. The irony in all this is that if you do not prosecute lawless behavior, you allow lawlessness to grow. And as you know, Edmund Burke famously said, all it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. We need our law enforcement. We need the rest of us to be supportive of them. The last point I'll make is that I spent time in more than 50 countries, both before and during being Assistant Secretary of State. And I will tell you, my job was to set up law enforcement all around the world. And one of the things that becomes very obvious is if you do not have that deterrent, if you do not have credible law enforcement, everything goes to Hades and a rocket ship real fast. And that we saw in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Colombia. I mean, you pick the country that has experienced instability, and we, you know, and so, you know, we certainly cannot lose that at home. I mean, we try our level best all around the world to help seed rule of law, and we certainly can't lose it at home.
Robert Charles, we appreciate so much both the clarity with which you address these issues, your historical perspective, and the great work that you do on behalf of the Association of Mature American Citizens. I know you'll come back to us again soon, and we look forward to it greatly. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.